On this week's prequel episode, we follow up on our Alice in Wonderland listener polls to learn about the thriller genre and preview High Rise. Hello and welcome back to another prequel episode of This Film Is Lit, the podcast where we talk about movies that are based on books. We have all of our segments, quite a bit to get to, so we're going to jump right into our patron shoutouts.
I put up with you because your father and mother were our finest patrons, that's why.
We have one new patron this week joining us at the $5 Hugo Award-winning level, getting access to that bonus episode every month. Kevin Smith, parenthetical, not that one. The answer, the question is asked and answered.
I don't know. That sounds like exactly what Kevin Smith would say if he didn't want us to know he's Kevin Smith.
You're not entirely wrong. I feel like that may be what's going on here. There's no way you can prove it. You send a picture of yourself and it'd be like, nope, that's not it. Nope.
Clearly a fake.
Yep, absolutely. But thank you, Kevin Smith, not that one, for supporting us at the $5 level. Hope you enjoyed that bonus content. And as always, we would love to thank our Academy Award-winning patrons, our top tier, and they are Eric, Harpo Rat, Nathan B., Vic Vega, Matilde, Steve from Arizona, Paul, Teresa Schwartz, Ian from Wine Country, Winchester's Forever, Kelly Napier, Gray Hightower, Gratch, Just Gratch, Shelby Is No More, That Darn Skag, V Frank, and Alina Starkov. Thank you all very much for your continued support. We appreciate it. Very, very nice stuff. I don't know what I'm saying. Thank you, though. It's great. You're the best. Katie, let's see what the people had to say about Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Okay, on Patreon, we had 7 votes for the book and 1 for the movie. Our first comment was from Kelly Napier, who said, "Shout out to Brian for referencing Calvin Ball. I talk about Calvin Ball all the time, and no one ever has any idea what I'm talking about. I feel so seen right now."
It's amazing to me that nobody knows what you're... Nobody... Calvin and Hobbes is an immensely popular...
I knew what it was.
No, I know. No, I'm not. Yeah, I'm just saying that I'm talking about Kelly's instance here of talking to people that don't know what it is. It's surprising to me because, yeah, it's...
I feel like a lot of people know Calvin and Hobbes but have not actually read Calvin and Hobbes.
That's fair. I mean, I'm sure that's true, but still surprises me that so many of them would not. I don't know. Calvin, I guess it is. It shows up pretty often in the comp. Yeah. But again, if you've never read it, if all you know Calvin and Hobbes is it's a tiger and a little dude who's like kind of like Dennis the Menace, then like probably
his house kind of look like Dennis the Menace.
I mean, not
I never
really.
Thought about
I,
it.
But I think that's how a lot of people kind of,
yeah,
in their head are like, yeah, it's the dude who pees on things. The worst travesty of all time. But yes, I love Calvin and Hobbes is probably my favorite comic, like that kind of, you know, comic strip, whatever you want to call it, ever. I've read like probably not all the books, but almost all the books. I had them all, a ton of them growing up, like the anthology collections. That and Far Side were two of my dad's favorites. And so we had all of those. And I've read lots of Far Side and lots of Calvin and Hobbes. But I absolutely love Calvin and Hobbes.
That should explain a lot to you guys about Brian's sense of humor.
Yes.
Kelly went on to say, "I voted for the book in relation to this movie. While truer to the source material than any other adaptation I've watched, something just felt like it was lacking to me as I was watching. I think I finally decided that all the vignettes felt too slow in the pacing in the movie. In the book, everything was happening so rapidly that it helped sell the idea of the absurdity of it. You weren't given time to process one thing that was said before you had to move on. I agreed with y'all about the addition of the moral to the story, that she had the ability to perform inside her the whole time. It wasn't necessary at all. I will say, I had a hard time not comparing this movie to the Disney one, which is a perennial favorite of mine. I know this isn't what we're talking about, but I liked better how the animation of the Disney version was able to embrace the absurdity better than this live-action adaptation. I'm excited to hear what you have to say about it in next month's bonus episode."
Yeah, we actually just watched that last night, and we'll be recording that episode here in the next day or two. So it'll be out sooner than later, probably, because we have a lot going on in April. So,
Yeah, we have a lot going on in April.
Yeah, so we actually recorded it early because we got tons of stuff. There's an eclipse happening, in case people didn't know. It's going right over our town, so that. And then we're going to some events. Yeah. We're going to a Viking festival. We got all kinds of stuff going on. So, yeah, we're going to be very busy in April. So we got that done early, so that episode should be out again within the next, I would say within the next week, but definitely within the next week or two, the episode will be out. But, yeah, we're recording it very soon. Yeah. So we will have lots to say, I'm sure.
Our next comment was from Nathan B., who said, I have mixed feelings on both the book and the movie and feel like both started slow but sort of won me over towards the end. The first book, Adventures in Wonderland, felt to me like Alice had been plopped down into a world entirely populated by Amelia Bedelia, the children's book character who takes everything literally, if that reference isn't clear. Oh, it was clear to me, Nathan. You never have to explain to me who Amelia Bedelia is.
I've heard of Amelia Bedelia, but I don't know if I've ever read Amelia Bedelia.
I wanted to scream at the characters, you know what Alice means. I also just found the meandering story to be frustrating and found the lack of resolution in each scene to be frustrating as we zoomed along to the next one. Like, I just wanted one part of the story to have a conclusion instead of just ending so the next part could happen. I did quite like the Griffin and the Mock Turtle because I enjoyed deciphering the meanings of their pun run about school. I much preferred Through the Looking Glass because Alice trying to get to the other side of the board provided a storyline and a straight-up list of all the areas and adventures Alice was about to go through. It also seemed appropriate that a little girl like Alice would feel like a pawn who wants to grow up and be a queen. I also loved the introduction of the meta elements. My favorite example was a gnat who whispers in Alice's ear on several occasions when she misses a pun that could have been used. This was a far more satisfying way to work in the puns than the constant misunderstandings of the first book. Oh, I will agree that I preferred Through the Looking Glass generally over Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. I think it was pretty clear to me that, like, the idea had been refined
a little bit more. No.
And I do think that there's something to the style of Adventures in Wonderland because it is a dream. So we're kind of like working with that like dreamlike quality where things will just change.
Right.
But I think I preferred Through the Looking Glass. It was also a little bit darker.
Yeah.
I felt like. Nathan went on to say the movie started out as a mess. The visual effects were rough, especially when they portrayed Alice changing sizes, and apparently the rabbit's twitchy running was done on purpose, but it seemed like a poor attempt at CGI. This, combined with the often arbitrary breaking into song, made me compare this to Cats even before the Cheshire Cat showed up.
I mean, it's a musical. Arbitrarily breaking into song is one of those things that happens, but
I felt bad for the talented actors being made to dress up in absurd costumes and sing bad songs. But then Gene Wilder showed up to do exactly that, and I loved every single second.
And I think arguably the worst costume, in my opinion.
Yeah, his costume compared to some of the other ones was not great.
It felt a little phoned in. Yeah.
He made it feel genuine and warm despite the absurdity. He really connected with Alice, despite likely never being in the same room while filming. Mm-hmm. Christopher Lloyd was also fantastic and made the White Knight a believable mentor for Alice. I also liked the doorman, who had just the right delivery to add a sense of detached sarcasm that I didn't find from the book. Overall, I don't think the few great acting performances were enough to outweigh the terrible visuals and ham-handed application of the framing device, but I certainly ended up disliking it less at the end than I expected to after the beginning. Overall, I kind of wonder why there have been so many attempts to adapt the books. Their lack of narrative and wordplay-based humor both seem a little out of place on screen. So I got to give it to the book.
I would agree with that. It definitely is one of those ones that's interesting that there have been so many attempts.
Yeah. And of course, there have been attempts because it has been so popular since its publication.
Yeah.
I would wager to say that might be the only reason that people keep adapting it. But I do think it's interesting. And I think it should be considered more unadaptable than it is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not one of those ones you ever hear people kind of, well, it's funny because the one High Rise, which we're doing, I read a comment somewhere. I don't think I included it in my notes, but I read a comment from somebody saying that at one point that book had been considered, quote, unfilmable. Mm-hmm. But like, this is one of those ones where it's like, maybe somebody should have said that about this, because yeah, it does seem like, I don't know if we need to keep trying to adapt this over and over again. I'm not sure. I like I said, my only point of disagreement in here is I don't think the visuals were terrible. In the film, I thought it looked pretty good overall. Especially, I thought like the sets and some of the camera work and shots were fine. Not all the CG holds up perfectly, yeah, but even that, I don't think
the like special effects, quote unquote, are dated. But I didn't think they were dated in a way that was like terrible.
No, I didn't find them like awful.
They were dated in a way that was like, yeah, this was made in 1999.
Yeah, it was kind of quaint, but it wasn't like, oof, that looks terrible. Mm-hmm. Like you're like, oh yeah, no, that's clearly, you know, that's clearly made in 20 years ago, 30 years ago almost, but it doesn't, yeah, it didn't like jump out of the page like, God, that looks awful mm-hmm. to me.
Next comment was from Steve from Arizona, who said, to be the contrarian, we would expect nothing else from you, Steve. To be the contrarian, I went for the movie. It's not due to the technical prowess or the idea of the film, but just as a kudos to this era of network television.
I can appreciate that. Yeah. This was a good era of TV.
Yeah. Before everything literally became CSI spinoffs and doctoral procedurals.
Yeah, like right before. Because we're like, we're just a, yeah.
Yeah.
5 to 10 years before that all happened.
This came out during an era where we saw a live-action Gulliver's Travels, which could be a March Madness for next year.
I believe I've watched that. I remember watching a made-for-TV Gulliver's Travels as a mm-hmm. kid that I really liked. Mm-hmm. It might be the one he's talking about. I don't know. But
and my guilty pleasure, Dinotopia.
I don't know what that is.
I have some extremely vague memories of Dinotopia, and I would be interested to watch it again to see how much. Well, I assume I've watched it. Maybe I just saw clips of it or at some point. But I would be interested to watch that. It's surreal watching Jenna Malone as a young girl and marveling at the length of her career, considering I just saw her this past week in Love Lies Bleeding, where she plays a battered housewife to a redneck Dave Franco.
Jenna Malone's not in this.
No, but I assume...
Oh, was it in was she in Dinotopia maybe. Or something?
Yeah, she was not in this.
Tina Majorino kind of looks like Jenna Malone.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's... It's possible that he's referencing either Dinotopia or Gulliver's Travels there. I don't actually know.
Or some other made-for-TV movie from this era, potentially.
Doesn't look like she was in Dinotopia. I don't know if she was in Gulliver's Travels. But anyways, but yeah, that just in case you were thinking Jenna Malone was in this movie, she was not. Just throwing it out there. Right? Unless she had a bit part I was unaware of.
I don't think she was in this movie.
I think he's thinking Tina Majorino was Jenna Malone. Anyway, sorry. Continue.
I also disagree with Brian about plotless stories. I tend to enjoy meandering stories that are either meant to convey coolness or frivolity or whatever. I can also understand it's not every person's cup of tea. It's the reason why I loved the recent film by Wim Wenders called Perfect Days.
I believe it's Wim Wenders. Wim Wenders? I could be wrong about that, but
I don't know.
I think it's Wim Wenders.
Well, it's spelled with a
I know.
Where it just feels like a slice of life rather than an actual plot-driven film. Either way, good episode as usual, and I'm definitely going to comment about High Rise. I just need to find the book. Steve, I just want to mention that I did a search on the IMDb page, and there were in fact 3 Steves who worked on Alice in Wonderland 1999. I'm a little disappointed that you didn't mention that there were 3 Steves in the crew.
You missed it. You missed out. Absolutely. And I will say that I don't mind pointless stories necessarily. I can enjoy a story that's a little aimless, and or a movie that's aimless in certain ways. Like I can enjoy certain like slice of life kind of like aimless movies. I can't think of a good example off the top of my head, but for me it's specifically the like zaniness of where it feels like it has a plot but it doesn't, and it or like a narrative but it doesn't, and I don't it's a very specific thing about this and Spirited Away and any Alice in Wonderland style story for whatever. Something about it just doesn't. Yeah, it's not just the aimless, like the pointlessness of it, because it's something more specific than that mm-hmm. that I'm not sure I can put my finger necessarily on.
We'll keep thinking about yes. it. Next comment was from Shelby Is No More, who said, I was glad to finally read this. I really enjoyed the dreamlike quality of the book, but I don't think it translates well on the screen. It's just not the medium it's made for. I guess that's why I prefer adaptations and retellings that don't try to keep that feeling and instead use the book as a jumping off point to make Wonderland a more traditional fantasy world. Leave that type of madness to the original text that was made for it.
Kind of what Nathan was saying.
Yeah.
Similar.
Which I don't even necessarily disagree with.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's hard to mimic exactly what the book is doing in a different medium.
Yeah.
And our last comment on Patreon was from Ian from Wine Country, who said, I'm with Brian, not a big fan of plotless stories. For having such a stacked cast, this was a real chore to watch. And I say that as someone who routinely watches the movies for god-awful movies.
There you go. Yeah, I can get that. I don't watch the movies for god-awful movies, but yeah. God-awful movies is a podcast where they watch, very similar to like Good, Bad, or Bad, Bad, but they watch specifically like religious movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which tend to be terrible, so. All right, that's what we got on Patreon. Thank you all for your comments.
Over on Facebook, we had 5 votes for the book and 0 for the movie. Sarah said, I voted for the books, but I do love this movie adaptation. I think the characters were well portrayed, and I enjoyed how the characters were present at the garden party, tying the through-line story together. I particularly love the sets, especially the caucus race and the pop-up book becoming the rabbit's house. It really adds to the childishness and the dreamlike state of the story. This movie isn't perfect. There are several noticeable editing errors, and it looks like a late 90s made-for-TV movie, but it is a great adaptation of the Alice story. Alice in Wonderland is my favorite fairy tale / fantasy story, and this is the movie I always direct people to.
Yeah. No, like I said, I think if I liked this story, I think I would enjoy this movie.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot I liked about the movie. Just couldn't get into it.
Our other comment on Facebook was from Adam. This was not technically on our feedback post, but I had to include it.
Yes, no, absolutely have to include this.
And Adam said, as a Cincinnatian, is that right?
Cincinnation?
Cincinnatian? Cincinnatian, I'm going to go with that. I can confirm I grew up eating mock turtle soup in the early 90s.
Huh.
I remember it being pretty good. But it's been long enough, I don't know how much of that is just nostalgia poisoning. I do my best to be vegan now for personal ethical reasons, so all I can have is mock turtle
mock,
soup.
Mock turtle soup. There you go. Thank you for chiming in, our local Cincinnatian. Cincinnation. I don't know. I think I'm like Martian.
I feel like we should go for something completely different, like maybe... Cincinnati? No, that doesn't work.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Never mind.
Yeah, I don't know. It cracks me up just seeing it written down, though. Cincinnati is one of those words that always messes with me. As watching Cardinals baseball games as a kid, it always cracked me up because I would always read it whenever they would go to Cincinnati and play the Reds. Still probably on the backstop behind him, it would say CincinnatiReds.com, like mm-hmm. their website. But when it's all written out lowercase as one word, Cincinnati Reds, it looks like Cincinnatires. And I always used to like read it as Cincinnatires. I don't know why, but that's how my brain always read Cincinnati Reds written out as one word, Cincinnatires.
We didn't have any comments on a couple of our platforms this time, but we had 3 votes for the book, 0 for the movie on Twitter. On Instagram, we had 6 votes for the book and 6 for the movie.
Wow.
Instagram is always a very interesting outlier place. Yeah, it's know. Always kind of an outlier.
I feel like our stuff gets thrown out to more random people on Instagram than like anywhere else. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we have more maybe like random people engaging. I don't know. Maybe not. I don't know.
And on Threads, we had 3 votes for the book and 0 for the movie. And then over on Goodreads, we had 1 vote for the book, nice. 0 for the movie.
Miko.
And Miko said, I had similar problems with the movie as Brian, where the pointlessness of the film made it hard to connect with it. I have seen similarly nonsensical art movies, but those felt like they had at least some feeling they tried to instill.
I think that's it, to some extent. I think that's part of it, is that it feels like a lot of times with those, like other pointless quote-unquote movies, like nonsensical arty farty movies that like maybe don't have a plot, because mm-hmm. I have seen some of those in my day. Oftentimes they're very clearly invoking a very specific emotion or feeling or mm-hmm. sort of, you know, that sort of thing. Whereas this movie, maybe it does more so for children, but for me, it does it. It's like, it's just like zany and wacky for this. Like, that's the only feeling is like, look how wacky it is.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that just doesn't do much. Whereas if it's like a pointless kind of aimless movie where it's like building this sense of like dread or this sense of, I don't know, ennui or so, like if it's something else, I can sometimes like get into it more, but this specific version of pointlessness doesn't. Yeah, I think that is a maybe one of the key components of what I was trying to get at.
All right. Okay. Miko went on to say, I'm sure there's some underlying reason or inspiration Lewis Carroll had when writing, even if it was just all the stuff I think kids like thrown in a blender. But I'm so far removed from the mid-1800s British worldview that I can only see the most obvious references. It just doesn't evoke anything cohesive, not really even enjoyment.
This is you're voicing my feelings, Miko. Thank you.
With a funnier story, I'd probably have tolerated it better, but as it is, it's just one weird scene after another. There are some nice visual effects and cool puppets. I especially liked the Griffin. But on the other hand, some of the effects haven't aged so well, and the humanoid designs for most of the animal characters left me wanting more.
That's something you mentioned.
Right? Yeah. I feel like the nonsense works better on a page when one can imagine it.
Yeah.
Based on my general knowledge of the story and vague memories of the Disney film, I was pleasantly surprised that the book Alice had some attitude and wasn't a totally passive observer.
I will say she is not in the Disney film either. We just watched it last night.
Yeah,
I don't think she's as passive as maybe you're remembering, potentially. She is a little bit, but
she is a little bit, but she's definitely less so in the book.
Yeah. Yes. I'm sorry. I'm not saying that it's. Yeah, it may even be more so in the book. I'm just saying in the movie, there's at least a tinge of that kind of obstinate. You know, she's not just a completely passive.
Yeah, she is definitely frustrated observer. With the whole situation.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, maybe it's. Yeah, I guess that's part of it, is that she maybe is in the Disney version is a little more like. Woe is me, like, you know, there's a whole sequence where she like sits and cries in the woods that maybe makes it feel a little, but there's other times where she does, you know, kind of stand up for herself and stuff in ways, like the whole scene with the croquet, like with the swan, and where she's like trying to fight the flamingo and I think maybe a little bit more than you remembered in that movie, but yeah, I'm sure the book is even more so.
Yeah. I understand why most adaptations seem to distill the book to its most iconic scenes. While I enjoyed the style quite a bit at the beginning of the book, it started to get tedious toward the end. Nonsense just for the sake of nonsense is fine, but I had to take frequent breaks to get through the book, even while I enjoyed it. Also, I'm sure as a non-native English speaker, there was a bunch of stuff I missed. Yeah, I think that would be a little bit rough with this one, because it is so heavily based in wordplay.
Yeah.
And also, like, I mean, you mentioned the mid-1800s
specific
Britain.
References.
Very specific references. Yeah. And like really, really specific references, because there's a lot, like if you really start to pick apart the history of Alice in Wonderland, there's a lot of like really niche references to like people who worked at Oxford when Lewis Carroll did and that kind of thing. So there's a lot you're gonna miss.
Yeah.
I think trying to adapt something like this to the screen necessarily means reining in the nonsense, which feels like going against the very basic idea of the story. I don't know if you both missed it or if there are multiple edits of the movie, but the tortoise taught us bit was in the movie I watched. It's also entirely possible that I wrote that down under the wrong section on my notes then didn't remember when we went back to record. In fairness to me, all of my sections of the notes are titled very similarly.
I think you did skip one line there where he said, that said, I still enjoyed the book more than not that important.
That said, I still enjoyed the book more than the movie. So Miko's vote was for the book.
Yes.
And our winner overall was the book with 25 votes to the movie's 7. Bit of a landslide this week.
Yes, indeed. All right. Thank you all so much for chiming in, letting us know what you thought and voting. We appreciate it. It's honestly, one of my favorite parts of doing this show every week is reading everybody's comments and seeing what people had to say. So we always appreciate it. Katie, it's time now to learn what exactly is a thriller.
No matter what anybody tells you, words and ideas can change the world.
I always struggle a little bit to come up with learning things segments when I'm not like overly familiar with the source material.
Right, yes,
But I don't think we've ever talked about the thriller genre. And then I was thinking about it and I kind of realized like I don't really know how that genre is defined. So I went ahead and looked. Thriller is a genre of fiction that is characterized and defined by the moods that it elicits, which I thought was really interesting. So thrillers give audiences heightened feelings of suspense, excitement, surprise, anticipation, and anxiety. The basic idea is to keep the audience on the edge of their seats, so to speak, as the story builds towards its climax. In short, if it thrills, it's a thriller.
I mean, sure, makes sense. I can't argue with that.
A few other things about thrillers, some common devices that they often use include like either the cover-up or the withholding of important information, red herrings, plot twists, unreliable narrators, and cliffhangers. Themes frequently include terrorism, political conspiracy, pursuit, romantic triangles leading to murder, thrillery things. Thrillers often have villain-driven plots, whereby there are obstacles that the protagonist or the hero must overcome in order to defeat the villain. But aside from just like heroes and villains, thrillers often utilize character archetypes such as the femme fatale, the sidekick, the Lothario, the vigilante, and the anti-hero.
Definitely.
Another thing that I thought was interesting as I was looking into this was that thrillers almost always overlap with other genres.
Yeah, pretty much.
Most notably crime, horror, and detective fiction. Although certainly not limited to those alone, but those are the few of the, like the most common ones.
Yes, I would say that's generally, because I often would say that like thrillers are like my favorite genre of like horror usually, kind of like generally speaking. It depends. There's other types of horror I like, but it's up there among my favorite style of horror stories is like a thriller kind of thing.
On the history of thrillers, I thought this was interesting. Some scholars argue that some ancient epic poems use similar narrative techniques to modern thrillers. Some examples that I saw mentioned were the Epic of Gilgamesh, Homer's Odyssey, and a specific tale from 1001 Nights, The Three Apples, which is a murder mystery with multiple plot twists.
I've obviously never read all of Gilgamesh or the Homer's Odyssey, but I have read excerpts from them, and I don't know. I would have to revisit that to see.
I would have to go back and look to see how much I agree with that. But I thought that was an interesting kind of take. A couple of not that old, but older texts that are maybe more recognizable as being similar to modern thrillers include Alexandre Dumas' The Count of Monte Cristo from 1844.
Not Crisco.
That's
you
not
almost,
what I said.
I know. That sounded like you were about to say the
count. I know.
You,
that's why I stopped.
I know, but it just made me laugh.
I always
think of it that way in my head. So it made me laugh that you almost said it that way. Because, The Count of Monte Cristo.
Erskine Childers' The Riddle of the Sands from 1903 and The 39 Steps from 1915. Thrillers were also especially popular post-World War II, during the height of the Cold War, when professional spies and political intrigue dominated the genre.
North by Northwest.
Yeah. The thriller genre, my last note here, is also especially well-suited to film and television, according to the internet, with directors like Fritz Lang and Alfred Hitchcock setting the standards for the genre to this day.
Yeah, I mean, Alfred Hitchcock probably maybe the most well-known, like most of his most well-known movies, I think, fit into the thriller genre. Yeah. Ones we've done, Rear Window, Psycho, I think, kind of fits into, like, we talked about Psycho in the context of slashers, too, but it's also, like, very much a thriller
for
most of it. And Fritz Lang has directed one of my... A very fascinating movie, like I think one of the very first talkies, I think, right around the period where film was transitioning from silent film to talkies. He directed a film called M.
Yeah,
I actually have it, and I think out there somewhere. That I think is just a fascinating, really cool like movie. It's interesting. It's about like a a serial pedophile, I think, or something like that. But it's a really really interesting, fascinating movie, especially because it's so, again, it's sort of like 1927 or something like that, or very early in, like I said, one of the first talkie movies. Much of it is kind of silent, but there are like scenes where you have conversation. It's been a long time since I watched it, but watched it in a film class and really liked it. All right, now you know a little bit more about thrillers. Let's learn about the thriller we're talking about this week, High Rise.
For all its inconveniences, Lang was satisfied with life in the High Rise. Ready to move forward and explore life. How exactly? He had not yet decided.
I'm so sorry.
I'll survive.
I thought you were empty.
I just moved in.
You're an excellent specimen. Why don't you come up later and have a drink?
You don't know how things work around here, do you?
I'm a fast learner.
You built all this.
I put all my energies into this town, but I am the architect of my own accident.
Is that a horse?
Probably.
On the 40th floor.
Your husband appears intent on colonizing the sky.
And who can blame him when you look at what's going on at street level?
High Rise is a 1975 novel by British writer J.G. Ballard.
Mm-hmm.
Some of Ballard's other novels that you may have heard of include Crash, Concrete Island, and Empire of the Sun.
Yes, Crash is the one we mentioned in Secretary, because there's a James Spader-led film adaptation of that. It's about people that get off on car crashes, directed by Cronenberg. there's also an Empire of the Sun film. I don't know about Concrete Island, but or at least I'm fairly certain there's an Empire of the Sun.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
Ballard's style of literary fiction is actually so distinctive that he became an adjective... Ballardian, defined as, quote, resembling or suggestive of the conditions described in J.G. Ballard's novels and stories, especially dystopian modernity, bleak man-made landscapes, and the psychological effects of technological, social, or environmental developments. So fun stuff.
So Alex Garland is Ballardian.
Yeah.
Yeah. Among other people, but yeah, the first one, one of the first ones that definitely jumps to mind.
I could only find one contemporary review of this, and I couldn't read most of it because it was paywalled. Thank you, ProQuest. But Brian M. Stableford, writing for Science Fiction Foundation, said, quote, High Rise works, like all imaginative fiction, through the method of strategic exaggeration. So something to look forward to, I guess.
Okay.
And then a couple notes from the legacy section on this book's Wikipedia article, because it was kind of cracking me up.
Okay.
First note here, the book has been cited as an influence on the 1987 Doctor Who serial Paradise Towers.
I saw that. I've never seen that specific Doctor Who serial. I've never watched any old Who. I've only ever watched new Who, but yeah, that's interesting.
And then the next three notes are all really similar. British rock band Hawkwind used the book as the basis for a song of the same name on their 1979 album PXR5.
Mm-hmm.
Canadian post-rock band Godspeed You Black Emperor listed it among their recommended reading list to coincide with their appearance at All Tomorrow's Party's music festival.
If I ever get a recommended reading list before going to a music festival and be like, pardon me, what are we doing here?
And High Rise was known to be among Joy Division singer Ian Curtis's favorite books.
There you go.
So for some reason, this book was really popular among rockers, I guess.
But specifically, it looks like kind of cerebral, like,
yes,
political,
yes,
minded rockers. Yes. Yeah. All right. But speaking of that book, we're going to talk now about the adaptation that was made of it in 2015. It's High Rise.
How's the high life?
Prone to fits of mania, narcissism, and power failure.
We pay the same charges as the top floors. We want our fair share of the power.
Things would be better if we could afford to move to a higher floor.
I think we should be prepared to meet moderate resistance.
The ones who are the real danger are the self-contained types like you.
Perhaps you're right.
What are you doing? What are you doing in there?
Teething problems. Building's still settling.
Doesn't it seem odd that a man can fall from the 39th floor and not one police car turn up? Where's the sirens?
What have you got there?
A kaleidoscope.
What can you see through that thing?
The future.
High Rise is a 2015 film directed by Ben Wheatley, known for Free Fire, Kill List, Rebecca, Meg 2, The Trench, and then two Doctor Who episodes, actually, Deep Breath and Into the Dalek, which you just watched not that long ago. Those are two of the early Peter Capaldi ones.
Is Into the Dalek is the one where they go inside the Dalek.
Yes.
And I don't remember
Deep Breath is the first episode of season 8, I believe. I think it's Capaldi's first episode.
Oh.
Like, his first main episode that isn't like the special or whatever. Right. I'm pretty sure that's I think that's the one where they're in like where the T-Rex comes back to London.
Okay.
And
yeah
not
okay.
A super memorable episode, but I believe that's which one it is. But yeah, we just watched those not that long ago, but I thought it was interesting he directed two episodes of Doctor Who. And Meg 2, The Trench, which just came out like last summer and everybody hated. But Rebecca, too. So another adaptation, which is interesting. And the film was written by his actual his wife, Amy Jump, who wrote Free Fire, Kill List, Sightseers, which Sightseers I left off his list, but was his first film. So they're kind of a husband-wife writing, directing duo.
So she didn't write Meg 2, The Trench?
She did not write Meg 2, The Trench that I saw.
Maybe that's why everyone hated it.
Yeah. The film stars Tom Hiddleston, Jeremy Irons, Sienna Miller, Luke Evans, Elizabeth Moss, and James Purefoy. The film has a 60% on Rotten Tomatoes, a 65% on Metacritic, and a 5.5 out of 10 on IMDb. And really interestingly, on Google, so when you Google like a movie, it shows you like the Google reviews, or like it pops up that little like window that has like a 5-star ratings, and it shows. And I thought this was fascinating because I confirmed that this wasn't the case on IMDb. When I saw the 5.5, I thought, oh, maybe this will be similar on IMDb, and it's not. On IMDb, it has a pretty standard, like, bell curve of, like, you know, a few tens, and then mostly sixes, and then back down, kind of like to,
like a few ones and twos.
Yeah, yeah. On Google, though, it has a 2.7 out of 5. They do, like, a 1 to 5 ratings, star rating thing. And the vast majority of the ratings are either 1 or 5 stars, and a plurality of those are 1 stars. It has more 1-star reviews than anything else, but it has the second most number are 5-star reviews. So it's one of those that seems very polarizing, which is interesting. Usually often means it's good sometimes, not always, but it can often mean it's good. The film made $4.1 million against a budget of $8
million.
Woof. Makes sense because I had never heard of this movie. It came out like 2 years after freaking Avengers, or 3 years after Avengers. Right. Tom Hiddleston, at the peak of his popularity, never heard moment one or, you know, one thing about this movie. So I don't know how well they marketed it. So the film was produced by Jeremy Thomas, who's a British film producer, who is probably most known for his work on The Last Emperor, which is a film that won Best Picture in 1987 about the last emperor of China, I believe. Little kid, you would recognize the poster. I recognize the poster. I've never seen the movie. But he apparently had wanted to adapt this book since like the 1970s. Mm-hmm. He had tried and failed several times over the decades to get this project off the ground, each time with different directors and writers attached to it. Initially, Nicholas Raeg was attached as the director for the first iteration when they tried to get it going, who we've actually covered before, because he directed both The Witches, 1990, and Don't Look Now, which we've done.
Another thriller.
Yes. Which I remember quite liking Don't Look Now. Then in 2013... Ben Wheatley, the director of this film, got interested in the story and was like looked in to see like who had the rights to the book because he wanted to adapt it, which led him to Thomas, and they ended up working together. And Wheatley described his desire to adapt the book by saying, quote, "The book makes as much sense now as it did then. It was written in the 70s, projecting itself into a near future, but we live in that future now. We're almost in a new version of the 70s, end quote.
But we live in that future now is always a comforting thing to hear about a dystopia.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So a couple other little facts. There wasn't a ton out there about this because, again, nobody's ever heard of this movie. I say nobody, that's not fair, but a lot of people have not heard of this movie. But this one I thought was interesting. Clint Mansell did the score for this, who's probably most known for being Darren Aronofsky's composer, who he did Requiem for a Dream, The Wrestler, Black Swan, Noah, a bunch of other stuff, and stuff outside of Darren Aronofsky. But he's also the person responsible for maybe the most overused song in student film trailers and or conspiracy theory YouTube videos, Lux Aeterna. If you look up Lux Aeterna, do you know what that is?
No, I'm sure I'll recognize it, but just on the name, I don't know what that is.
I'll put it in here. It's from Requiem for a Dream.
Oh.
Hold on.
Oh, yeah.
Get to the good part. Hold on. This.
Yeah. I didn't know that was what it was called, but I have definitely heard that.
Yes. It's from Requiem for a Dream, written by, scored by Clint Mansell. Mm-hmm. But yes, it shows up everywhere all the time.
A movie I have never seen.
I've seen it. Actually, I've not seen all of it. I've seen parts of it. I watched some clips from it.
Is it based on a book? Is there a book?
I actually don't know. I don't think it is, but it might be. It's got Jared Leto in it, so.
So at this point in my life, I just ask that about
every movie. I know, about
every
movie, right?
I'm like, is it based on a book?
Yeah. It's one of those movies that always gets cited as the most, like, one of those movies that people watch and then never want to ever see again because it's just it's wildly depressing. It's about, like, drug addiction. Like, it's not a fun movie.
Oh, it is based on a book.
There you go. We
can
based
do on the 1978 novel of the same name by Hubert Selby Jr.
Yeah. We can watch it and be depressed on the podcast.
No promises. maybe someday.
This is a fun fact from IMDb. It's the only one that, but I thought it was fun. In the opening shot of the film, the character Lang, who is Tom Hiddleston's character, is listening to a record on a record player, but it's apparently a very rare record player known as a transcriptor's reference turntable. And it was the same one that was owned by Alex in the film A Clockwork Orange, which is very obviously a reference to based on
Speaking of movies that you see once and then never want to watch again.
Like, usually number one and number two on the list is like Requiem for a Dream and Clockwork Orange are like very high on that list usually. So, yeah. And then finally, a few reviews for this film. Tim Robey for The Telegraph gave the film 4 out of 5 stars and praised its brutality and its dark comedy. IGN gave the film a 7 out of 10, saying it was, quote, enjoyably dark and disturbing, enjoyingly dark and disturbing adaptation of one of J.G. Ballard's best. For Variety, Kate Wilson gave the film a 5-star review, calling it a masterpiece. And then writing, I thought this was funny, for Architects Journal, because this movie is about an architect, yeah. I think, or one of the characters. I think Jeremy Irons' character, I believe, is an architect who designed the high-rise they're in. At least from the trailer, that's what it seemed like. Laura Mark was impressed by, quote, the fantastic visuals, but noted that it lacked plot. Also went on to say that the dystopia portrayed reflected current concerns regarding gentrification and division. There you go.
All right.
That is what they had to say. It's the review from Architects Journal on.
I love that. Yeah, honestly,
I had to include that when I saw that. I was like, "That's amazing." As always, I wanted to remind you, you can head over to Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Goodreads, any of those social media platforms. Follow us, do all that stuff. We like that. You can also head over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, give us a 5-star rating review. All that's also very helpful. And head over to Patreon.com/thisfilmislit, and you can support us like all of our lovely patrons. And if you support us at the $15 and up level, you get priority recommendations, which means you get to tell us what you want us to talk about, which this one is.
This was a request from Jeff Niederhofer, who's not currently subscribed, but
had been for quite
a while. Has been a long-time patron, yes. And had this one request that was outstanding.
Yes.
And we do, you know, if you have been a patron for a long time, we will honor your outstanding requests.
Yeah.
If you're not able to subscribe
if
anymore.
There's it, not like in perpetuity, you can't request 20 things and we'll just do them forever, but like, you know, you got like one or two that's
within reason.
Yeah.
But Jeff had been a long time patron. Yes, so.
Absolutely. All right, Katie, where can people watch High Rise?
Well, as always, you can check with your local library or a local video rental store if you still have one. Barring that, you can stream this with a subscription to Netflix, Prime Video, Hulu, Hoopla,
it's on everything,
Vudu, Tubi, Pluto TV, Plex, and Distro TV.
You know what? This makes sense that this could be on everything, because it's one of those movies where like the cast has enough names that it's like an attention getter. Like you see the poster, you're like Tom Hiddleston and Jeremy, like what, Elizabeth Moss, like what? And but it's also a movie that like, who care? Like nobody's ever heard of, so it's probably cheap to get the rights.
Yes, absolutely.
So I could see, I don't know if that's why it's on everything, but it is interesting that it's apparently on everything.
You can also rent it for around $4 from Apple TV, Amazon, YouTube, Vudu, or FlixFling.
There you go.
And speaking of, you mentioned the like the names and everything, and I just wanted to say, so the book that I ended up getting, I buy all our books secondhand through a website called Thrift Books, and I try not to get the movie tie-in novels, but sometimes they send them. And for this one, we got a movie tie-in edition, and I think my favorite thing about it so far is that the movie poster is very clearly trying to trick me into thinking it's a James Bond movie.
It definitely has that kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I watched the trailer and I'm actually really excited for this. It looks right up my alley. It looks like it's like probably not as much of an action movie, but it's like, what if Snowpiercer was a building? But like with less action. I don't think it's going to be as much of like a, you know, Snowpiercer is like a beat 'em up like action movie.
Right.
I don't think that's going to be this, but it seems like a similar thing. Like it's very much like the
like class commentary.
And then shit goes crazy and it looks I think I'm going to like it, but who knows? Maybe not. It may suck, but I just based on the trailer, I think I'm going to be into it.
Yeah, I need to start reading the book. I have not started it yet. This probably would have been one we did as a Switch episode, but you're supposed to be reading something else.
What? Oh yeah. Yes. Yeah, I'm getting to it.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I gotta start reading that. Yeah.
What a tease.
All right, that's gonna do it for this episode. As always, I don't know, as always. That's the end. What the That's right. Yeah, well, in 1 week's time, we're talking about High Rise. You can come back then, guys, gals, I'm Marion Powell and everybody else. Until that time.
Keep reading books.
Keep watching movies.
And keep being awesome.
We just recorded Good Bad or Bad Bad the other day, and my brain forgot what I say where. So that's what happened there. Bye.